of this amendment. So I want to clarify clearly that today, the purpose of today's and tomorrow's meetings is to select preferred alternatives for each subregion and to approve the DEIS for public comment and initial submission to NOAA. These are not final decisions. They're scheduled to be made in September in Cape Cod. We're going to have multiple public hearings in at least one committee meeting, which will be scheduled sometime this summer. So there's going to be plenty of opportunity for the public to speak today, tomorrow, and throughout the upcoming public hearings. I'm going to go to the audience for comments and questions before the council's debate on every motion. Because we're expecting a crowd larger than you are here this afternoon, I'm going to limit your comments to 3 minutes apiece and insist that they be solely on the preferred alternative. Dave, could you raise your hand? Is going to be helping me regulate your time. So, and again, please understand that there'll be extended opportunities for public comment. We've been wrestling with a number of questions and concerns whether the council should select preferred alternatives. There is no legal requirement, it's considered good practice to do so, as preferred alternatives are known. It helps the industry and the public frame their comments in a way that will be useful for this council's final decision. You should all remember that in December, the RA suggested that the industry and public develop a straw man of preferred alternatives. In your supplemental materials, there are at least three that combine alternatives into a package, one from the industry and two from the ENGOs. These all may form the basis for consideration of a suite of preferred alternatives. Some of these packages suggest adding new alternatives. From a process standpoint, that will surely slow down the timeline of completing this action, but there are no legal impediments with adding new alternatives. So the game plan, at least tentative game plan, is following my overview here, Dave Preble, the Habitat Chair, will make some comments, and then we're going to turn it over to Michelle for a brief overview of the changes made to the document since December. I'm going to allow for clarifying questions from the council only, at which point we'll probably be close to lunchtime. And we'll come back and proceed directly into the Western Gulf of Maine. You've all received a very thorough discussion document. Thank you, Michelle and Andy and staff, for putting this together. We are going to follow the discussion document for our discussion today. In each sub-area, we're going to deal with the management areas, spawning areas, and DHRA separately before moving on to the next sub-area. So following any motions from the council, I will be going directly to the audience for questions and comments on the preferred alternatives for that measures and sub in that specific subregion. Is everyone comfortable with that? David, do you have a question?
Yeah, I've got a question. Terry, you said that new alternatives that will be offered up or have been offered up are in play. They're fair game. If indeed that is the case and we decide to favor one of them, include them or give preference, well, probably not preference, but to fit, to include them in the mix, would you be able to comment on how that would affect when we would make final decisions? Would that likely postpone final decisions in September to later on, beyond September, or would we still be able to make the September deadline?
Yeah, thanks for raising that, David. Tom and I have had some discussion about this. I'm going to turn it over to him.
There's a couple ways to deal with new alternatives that may be suggested today or that have been suggested in the letters. One way is not to add anything to the document now, to vote on preferred alternatives or not, as you choose, and to vote to submit the documents so that we can try and stay on schedule. At that point, after public comments, you always have the option of reacting to public comments, presumably including these public comments, and you could add alternatives down the road. If you do that, and they're not really covered by the analysis, I suspect that Gene is going to tell us that you either need to do a supplementary environmentalist document to go with it, and you may have to go out to public hearings again later, should you make a substantive change. So another possibility is you can add alternatives, analyze them before public hearings and submission, basically tell the staff to go off and analyze it, and then submit the document when you're done. but not choose them as preferred alternatives today, since you haven't seen any of the analysis of them that compares them to other alternatives. That's one choice you could do. A third choice is you could add alternatives today, select them as preferred, have the staff analyze them for public hearing and submission, but don't bring back the document to the council. Just tell the staff to complete the analysis and then take the submit it and take the document out for public hearing. And then the fourth choice is you could add alternatives, analyze them, bring the package back for another crack at choosing preferred alternatives, let's say at the June council meeting, and then submit the document later. I think that anything that starts with add alternatives, you run the risk that you're not going to make the September council meeting. It's a little difficult to say exactly how much it would delay it because I think it depends on how involved and how many changes are made. If there's a relatively minor change made to an alternative that is currently in the document, that may not necessarily push back our timeline. If there are major changes made to the document, then the staff is going to have to analyze them, and that is likely to delay the submission. I don't know if it's going to delay it enough yet to push it back to September. I would point out that from our standpoint, ours being the staff standpoint, while there's no legal impediment to adding alternatives, we actually think this is potentially a bad process thing to do. Last June was the meeting when we said we were going to select alternatives for analysis in the Habitat Amendment. We've actually added or modified alternatives every council meeting since then, which is problematic because every time that happens, the staff has to redo or do additional analyses. So that's just something to keep in mind. I guess in a nutshell is that there is, depending on how many alternatives get added and how complicated there are, there is a concern that we have that we may not be able to make a final vote at the council meeting, in the first council meeting in the fall, the end of September, first week of October.
Doug.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just would like to have a little clarification of what you consider as subregions, because as I was listening to your game plan here, it sounded like you wanted to take motions for preferred alternatives by subregions. Are you talking about subregion Gulf of Maine, Georgia's Bank, Southern New England, or are you talking subregions Eastern Gulf of Maine, Central Gulf of Maine, Western Gulf of Maine?
The discussion documents are laid out in the subregions by Western Gulf of Maine, Central Gulf of Maine, and Eastern Gulf of Maine.
I would suggest that when we first that it would be more appropriate, especially as we deal with Gulf of Maine, that we deal with it as a whole. When we had this broken up into subregions, it was for the purpose of helping the council and the public get their hands around this very complicated document. Given that we manage by stock complexes, and we have Gulf of Maine stock complexes, we have Georgia's Bank stock complexes, I think it's more appropriate that we put together a suite of alternatives for the Gulf of Maine as opposed to taking one at a time. I think it's a much more effective way of doing it from a habitat protection standpoint.
Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think in addition to the expediency of breaking up into subregions, the Gulf of Maine into subregions, those subregions were defined based upon hydrographic characteristics. They're very distinct. Central Gulf of Maine has deep water. Eastern Gulf of Maine is different from Western Gulf of Maine. And my understanding of the DEIS, that was the reason why they were broken up. It's not necessarily just for procedural purposes, although that certainly helps. I agree with you on that one. But there's some fundamental hydrographic reasons why those regions were defined as they were.
Other comments, questions from the council? Okay, turn it over to Dave and Michelle.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's evident from the nature of the questions that just arose that this has been a very, very difficult process, in addition to being very extended. At this point, though, we're at the denouement of this very long process, and as Terry has pointed out, we're not at the end. We've still got to go through public hearings, the final analyses, and the submission. But at this point, I think we can say we're at the beginning of the end. I'm going to take just a couple of minutes to address a question I was asked to deal with here. Actually, there are two questions, and Michelle is going to deal with another one. The question that came up, has been coming up on a regular basis, is a questioning of the actual need for habitat protection. And it's been stated several times along this process that there's no evidence of a link from bottom habitat to productivity. By productivity is generally meant the amount of fish that we can harvest. This is not true. And in fact, I think what we have here is an untruth that, if often repeated, begins to sound like the truth. Just as we've seen that the process itself is very difficult, it's also difficult to quantify the benefits of habitat protection. Difficult, but not impossible. And there's abundant scientific information that the benefits are real, although not as easy to analyze as an economic benefit. The fact is that a fundamental understanding of the bioenergetics that this is based upon is more than a century and a half old. It's not even new science. And the basic structure is that energy flows continuously from the sun to the earth and is used to drive cycles of nutrients and minerals that build and maintain all living things in a process that is, and this is the key, it's continuous in both space and time. Life in any form on the earth is continuous. There is no break in it any place within the biosphere. That includes every part of the ocean, even in New England. And it's connected in an unbroken web of the energy, minerals, nutrients, and living things. There is no place in this process that's unbroken, any place on the surface of the earth. There is no human exploration or scientific research that has ever found a single exception to this, any place on the surface of the earth. It's like gravity. It's a continuous process that exists everywhere. Our job as council members that we've sworn to do is to protect this structure for human life and for the benefit of our nation. So having said that, I'm going to turn it over to Michelle so that we can begin doing that job of protecting the resource so we can finally bring the fisheries away from the devastation that we've seen from continuous single-species management without consideration for anything else. Michelle?
Thanks. Good morning. I'm just going to go through a few introductory slides. You have copies of this. There are also some copies outside, and Joan just got it up on the web. She's having some technical issues. So it's there as well if you want an electronic copy. Briefly, to let you know what the other materials are, most of the documents are actually volumes of the EIS, and I'll go through what those are in a couple slides just as a reminder and point out some of the major updates. But you also have a decision document, as was mentioned, this presentation, and then there's a couple of different PDF documents that have comments. The first one, I think document 7, is comments that we got through the binder mailing on the 14th, and then the second one, 7A, are comments that we received through noon on the 20th, which was the mailing deadline for this meeting in terms of public comments. And then I believe you have also some additional comments that were distributed by the authors at your places, and there are some of those outside as well. The chair went through this, so I'm not going to repeat it, just the purpose of what we're doing today. In the decision document is a full list of the goals and objectives of the amendment, and these are just some of the major ones. We talked about this in December, so I'm not going to go into these either. Basically, a lot of what we're doing is related to designation of EFH, minimization of adverse effects of fishing on EFH. I did want to talk a little bit about practicability. This is something that's, I think, going to increasingly come up as we conclude this amendment. And really, I think hopefully the rest of the technical teams would agree with me, but the way I would explain practicability is it's trying to look at the trade-off between benefits to the benthic habitat, resources, including groundfish resources and other species that are managed by the council or other councils, versus costs in terms of economic or social costs. In some cases, we expect those positive habitat or resource benefits to accrue over a fairly lengthy period of time. Obviously, you know, you could model this, but it's difficult to estimate these benefits in dollars and say this amount of habitat protection translates into this increased rate of productivity that would generate this revenue for specific fisheries. So these are really kind of qualitative benefits. On the other hand, as we're thinking about practicability, the other side of that coin, the economic and social costs in many cases are easy to estimate in dollars. In many cases, those are, you know, short-term costs as well as long-term costs, and they may be different. So, you know, ultimately, as, you know, the technical teams will hope to provide for you some further discussion of some of these issues and lay some of this out in a way that, you know, can help inform, you know, the public's comments and also the council's final decisions. But, you know, these are challenging trade-offs to evaluate because you're talking about sort of things that can be quantified and things that really can't. There's another whole set of goals and objectives in the amendment that are really groundfish-driven, and these were added later, as you're well aware. And I'm not going to go through them, but I wanted to make a couple of comments, things that have come up. Just a reminder that these, you know, we have a number of existing management areas that were really designed around mortality reduction. And that's, in terms of the habitat management areas in this amendment, that's not, that wasn't a design criteria. It was really about protecting habitats that are vulnerable to fishing and in some cases that are known to contain aggregations of young juveniles. Something that Andy has put quite a bit of thought into, and there's some materials in the document that flesh this out, is just that there's a difference between the youngest juveniles and older juveniles. And there's a couple things, I guess, to think about is that first, their distributions are different. And so you don't necessarily see the age 0 and 1 juveniles in areas where you see older juveniles, and also that their retention in fishing gear is going to be different. So it's, you know, entirely reasonable that if your perspective on things is coming from the juveniles that you're retaining in your fishing gear, those may or may not be the juveniles that we're really focusing on in terms of the analyses in this amendment. So it's just kind of a reminder. There's a lot of information in the effect environment section about how those juvenile analyses were done, which areas have specific species, and that kind of thing. And then just another question that's been raised is sort of the linkages between the juvenile groundfish driven habitat areas and the more seabed impact analysis driven habitat areas. And even though the sort of two types of alternatives really came from two different processes that were sort of sequential, we developed the SASE approach first and then we added in the juvenile groundfish analysis. Ultimately, we would view all of those areas as having the purpose of minimizing the adverse effects of fishing on EFH. And a sort of design criteria for the juvenile groundfish-driven areas was, there should be an N on driven there. Sorry, I was late last night. whether the all of the juvenile groundfish-driven habitat areas do contain habitat types that are vulnerable to fishing, and we sort of looked at those areas through the lens of the swept area seabed impact analysis. So I think there is, you know, a lot of these two sets of areas I would really view in sort of one way. Certainly, each of these areas is somewhat unique and has different attributes in terms of the habitat characteristics, the fish that it protects, et cetera. But, you know, I wouldn't sort of be tempted to put them into two separate boxes. So you saw all these slides in September or December. I'm not going to go through them in detail. I did want to point out in Volume 1, it's mostly background information, the affected environment. Something that came up at the December meeting was a question about sort of what fraction of effort by different gears is actually covered in the VTR data. The VTR data are really central to the economic impacts analysis in particular. And we know that for some gear types and fisheries, all participants aren't required to submit VTRs because they don't have other federal permits. So that's the case for shrimp in some cases and lobster. So there's a whole section now in the effect environment that talks about sort of what the total universe of landings are, and that's based on dealer reporting versus what amount of landings come out of the VTRs. And so you can get a sense for any particular gear type, sort of what fraction of that gear type's effort is really covered in the trip reports. So if people have specific questions about that, we can talk about it offline or later in the day, certainly. Just a reminder that all the EFH designations, HAPC designations, are in Volume 2. We didn't make copies of that, but you do have it electronically. I think the main materials we'll be focusing on today are all in Volume 3, and that's the management alternatives themselves. Those are in Section 2, and then the environmental impacts, which are in Section 4. So the structure that the chairs proposed for us to take up these alternatives at the meeting is a little bit different than what's in the EIS. It's a little bit different than what's in the EIS. So in the EIS, it's grouped by habitat management, then ground fish spawning, then research areas, then framework adjustments and monitoring, whereas today we're going to sort of rearrange that a little bit more regionally and sub-regionally. And then the impacts are sort of topically and then according to the valued ecosystem component. The main thing that's been added, one whole section that's been added since December is a separate sort of species and fishery-specific discussion of impacts, and that's its own standalone section, 4.5. And then the other sort of major things that have been worked on since December are further work on the impacts on the physical and biological environment, sort of the benthic environment, really, and then also the remaining economic impacts discussions have been written. A lot of the, aside from updates, looking at specific alternatives that were added in December, the protected resources and large mesh groundfish analyses are pretty similar to what you saw at that meeting. Volume 4, a lot of this is sort of pending. It's, you know, at this point, it's really going to be about compliance with the law and also cumulative effects. So some of these things will be written before we do an initial submission, some later. And then all the appendices are in Volume 5. So just to put this up on the screen again, just to reiterate what the chair went through earlier, obviously the goal is to identify some preferred alternatives, and I'll go through and briefly describe the alternatives and some of the overall discussion about the impacts analysis by region or sub-region type of alternative. And the idea in terms of decision-making is to identify sets of areas and also to identify fishing restrictions. Hopefully everybody's aware of these at this point, but these are basically the four different management options for the action alternatives for habitat management. So if you see sort of referred to option 1, 2, 3, or 4, that's what those numbers mean, so you can refer back to this throughout the day if you'd like. In terms of spawning, the spawning alternatives are, the action alternatives are really based on existing areas, so taking subsets of existing areas. But generally the measures identified in those areas and written up in the document are the measures that are currently operant in the areas. But there's a couple of different sort of sub-options for the spawning action alternatives, just to remind people. So alternatives 2 or 3, option A would be closure really to commercial gears. That's generally speaking the measures that exist in these areas currently. And then option B would always be closure to both commercial and recreational gears that catch groundfish. And again, the commercial restrictions are generally based on existing measures. And in some cases, in the Gulf of Maine, for example, recreational groundfish restrictions would be different from no action. So I encourage you to look at the actual language in Volume 3, Section 2.2 for the details of these measures. So I just wanted to go through a couple of very general thoughts about sort of an analytical approaches and also some general conclusions. And then some of this you've seen in December, so I'm going to skim through it really quickly. And then some I'll spend a little more time, and then we can basically take some questions. So you saw this previously, that in terms of evaluating physical and biological habitats, it's really a question of what are the habitat types in different areas, what is their vulnerability. Historically, you know, what is there in terms of adverse effects that may have accrued by gear type, and what's the potential for redistribution of effort or changes in adverse effects sort of going forward. In terms of evaluating impacts to large mesh groundfish, the question is really, are there young juveniles or large spawners in the areas, and depending on the type of alternative. And then again, the question of how might fishing effort be redistributed, how would this affect these resources, depending on the types of gear types that are currently allowed or currently prohibited versus what would happen under the different alternatives. So sort of a theme throughout the document is trying to evaluate what are the effects if you change patterns of fishing effort. We spent quite a bit of time with the Scala PDT in terms of looking at that fishery and resource specifically. And so there's a couple different major things in that section of the document, looking at short-term and long-term yields in different management areas, those that have scallops at least. There are many of these that don't, particularly in the Gulf of Maine. We looked at some scenarios using the Scallop Area Management Simulator, or SAMS model. That hasn't been done for every potential scenario. I think maybe tomorrow we can get into detailed questions about these results once we get to the alternatives that really would affect the scallop resource and fishery. And I think Deirdre can speak to some of the issues and details better than I could. And then also in terms of the spawning alternatives, looked at variation seasonally in meat weight and how seasonal closures would sort of play into that. This managed species impacts on other stocks and managed species was really added since December. So there's a number of different species or groups of species that we looked at: small mesh multi-species, monkfish, skates, herring, deep sea red crab, surf clams and ocean quahogs, bluefish, squid, mackerel, butterfish, dogfish, summer flounder, scutblack, sea bass, tilefish, shrimp, and lobster. As you're aware, obviously some of these resources have considerable overlap with the management areas in this amendment, and some red crab would be an example, have pretty much no overlap with the management areas in this amendment. So that really drives, you know, a lot of the discussion and the impacts analysis. The other thing that is sort of a recurring theme is what is the status of those stocks? And the idea is that, you know, for stocks that are rebuilt and abundant, and where overfishing is not occurring, you're sort of less concerned about overlaps or new overlaps between management areas and fishing effort and the stocks, whereas there's, you know, sort of a greater concern for stocks that are in a more depleted status. Thorny skate might be an example of that, and it has some overlap with some of the areas in the Gulf of Maine. And then similar to the other impacts analyses, how might fishing effort be redistributed? How are these stocks, you know, species retained in different gear types, and how might that affect the resource? And also the fisheries. There's sort of some separate discussion about both the resource and the fishery. As I mentioned earlier, the economic analysis really, the VTR data is the primary data type we used because we have it for all gear types. And the analysis is really at the gear level and also then at the individual or permit level. I think we may have talked about this at a previous council meeting, but as opposed to just taking the VTR points and assuming that any effort from that trip is occurring where the point estimate is for commercial data, because we also have observer data, we can better estimate sort of the real distribution of revenue on those trips. And the way that those revenue distributions are constructed, it depends on a bunch of variables, trip length, gear type, et cetera. And so hopefully the revenue estimates that you see in the document provide a fairly realistic picture of how effort is actually distributed with respect to areas that are currently open. This will probably come up later today, but the recreational revenue distribution, because we don't have corresponding observer data to say where individual fishing locations are with respect to that single VTR point, it's a simple inside-outside approach. So if a recreational party or charter trip that's reported on VTR is inside an area, it's considered to be occurring in that area. If it's outside the area, it's not considered to be occurring in the management area. And that's just simply based on sort of the data we have available to us. And then for fisheries and for gear types that we do have VMS data, those are provided for comparison with the VTR data. And then another sort of the fourth element of the analysis was trying to guess what type of fishing effort could occur inside areas that are currently closed should they reopen. And we had a very sort of specific analysis for scallops that I talked about earlier, but for other species of groundfish, for example, we looked at observed catch sort of in a buffer zone around the currently closed areas to figure out what species are being caught on those trips to estimate sort of what species might be caught inside the areas if they reopen. Obviously, it's, you know, much easier to evaluate potential displacements from areas that are currently open than to estimate potential catch out of areas that are currently closed. So in terms of comparing, in some cases, changing no action versus designating a new area, we don't really have apples to apples, but that's just sort of the way things go. I think that was just duplicate. So I mentioned impacts are disaggregated by gear type. We have in the decision document and in this presentation later some sort of overall conclusion statements about this alternative will have a positive impact or a highly positive impact or a slightly negative impact. That's sort of taking all the different fisheries that and gear types that, you know, some may have a very high impact, some may have little effect of the different alternative and sort of combining them. There's a lot of nuance to providing a single, this has a positive economic impact that isn't communicated in the decision document and is detailed in the EIS. And it really sort of depends on your perspective or your gear type that you're really interested in. So in some cases, you know, there are, for a given alternative, there are certainly gear types that are going to be winners and losers, I guess, so to speak. The other thing to think about when looking at the economic impacts analysis is that there's often a distinction made between short-term impacts and long-term impacts. Generally, if it looked like the habitat and groundfish conservation outcomes of an alternative were fairly poor, we assume that long-term impacts could be negative, even if you have short-term gains in revenue. In some cases, the short-term gains are very large, and that may sort of outweigh, you know, long-term costs in other fisheries. Or so, you know, just looking at a simple positive, negative, highly positive is really a simplification of a pretty complex issue because we're trying to look at so many fisheries at once. Social impacts analysis, again, is looking at different communities, and it sort of used the data from the economic VTR analysis as the starting point. And asked which communities are going to be affected, and then those communities obviously have different rates of participation, commercial fishing, vulnerability. And the impacts analysis also thinks about sort of the attitudes and values of fishermen and stakeholders and how those might be affected by the alternatives. In terms of the protected resource analysis, we're really looking at different protected resources, how they overlap the different management areas, which gear types are of concern with respect to interacting with protected resources. Generally speaking, the negative impacts on either mammals or sturgeon are related to increases in the use of gill nets. In some cases, that's because the alternative proposes reopening an existing area that's closed to gill nets. For example, if the Western Gulf of Maine were to reopen, then there could be gill net fishing in there, even if it remains some kind of mobile gear habitat closure. Mobile bottom gear habitat closure. The other way that we assume that you could have increase in gill net use is if you designated a mobile bottom tending gear closure in a new area, and sort of having eliminating those mobile gears would maybe facilitate increased fishing by gill nets. You know, we don't know exactly the rate at which that would occur. And in general, you know, the protected resources impacts aren't expected to be significant, generally neutral, negligible, or a little bit negative. In the case of turtles, that's because turtles don't really overlap most of these management areas. And in the case of marine mammals or sturgeon, that tends to be because existing protected resources-focused management measures, for example, pingers or seasonal closures, really mitigate a lot of the impacts and changes that adjusting spatial management might cause. So I think that's really all I have in terms of introduction. I'm happy to take any questions now, and obviously later as we get to individual areas and results.
Yeah, thank you, Michelle. Terry?
Yeah, I questions on the spawning, the section 2.2, Michelle, page 90, on in the number 3. Just wondering how we arrived at the Western Gulf of Maine and the Cassius Ledge closure as a year-round default spawning closure.
Tom?
So I think this is, first off, the document doesn't identify them as spawning closures. NEPA requires that if we have spawning activity, NEPA requires that if you have a management measure, you have to compare it to no action. And in this case, so when we have a document like this one, which is large and which has closures that address different types of measures, habitat management, spawning, and at least research, if not other goals and objectives, but those are broadly based, then we struggled a little bit with how to identify the no action alternative to make sure that we're comparing what no action means with respect to spawning with changes in spawning closures. So the document, you'll notice, has got each of these sections has a no action alternative described. And so to get to your specific case, in the case of spawning, we have a suite of closures that are in place that may not have been specifically identified as spawning closures, but may have impacts on spawning activity. And so when the analysis is performed for spawning, we say, okay, if we don't make any changes, then those closures are in place, and we evaluate whether they have any effects on spawning activity or not. And then we compare the other alternatives to those. So that's why it's structured that way.
Other questions for Michelle? Matt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to go back to your overview of the economic analyses, if I could. First off, you made a statement earlier that the benefits of a given measure are more difficult to quantify than the discrete costs. I just want to make sure, is that a fair assessment of what's going on? Are you having a hard time in your economic analyses considering what the ultimate benefits might be of a closure, based upon the fact that it's more difficult to discretely quantify what they might be?
So, yeah, I think that's accurate, that it's hard to estimate benefits and more straightforward to estimate potential costs, especially short-term costs. I mean, speaking for the scientists that wrote the economic analysis, I think it is a little bit challenging to come to some kind of comprehensive evaluation of what is the overall net impact benefit to in terms of the economics. It's entirely possible, you know, given the individual results by gear type and the discussion of short-term and long-term, that individual council members would not reach the same end conclusion depending on their perspective and their read on the data. Hopefully the write-up in the document is detailed enough to show, you know, impacts by gear type, and in many cases that translates to impacts by fishery for gear types that are used in, you know, really one fishery. And it, you know, distinguishes what we think is short-term versus the long-term and how those interact. But, those are challenging sort of net conclusions to come to.
If I could have a follow-up. You mentioned economic practicability. Do you have a standard to assist you in your analysis of economic practicability that you can work with?
Well, it would be nice if someone else had maybe come up with one. The regulations are really general in this regard. You know, it's basically what I said. You know, you have benefits that you expect to accrue from your adverse effects minimization measures, and then there are costs, which are, you know, really economic costs. And that's sort of the level of guidance we have. I mean, you know, I think, you know, what we hope to do is convey to you that what we expect the benefits to be and what we expect the costs to be, and then it's, I guess, sort of up to each of you to determine what your own practicability standard is. Not to pass the buck, but, you know.
If I can follow up with that one, perhaps this might be a question that we could direct to the regional administrator. Is there any guidance from the service about economic practicability that could help us wade through this very complicated array?
Don't think so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all for now.
Gene.
Well, there is in the regulations, there is a short paragraph that describes the regulations dealing with essential fish habitat that describes practicability in very general terms, looking at short-term and long-term costs. I think that's the closest you can find to an actual formal. Right, and that paragraph refers to the national standard, which deals with efficiency and cost benefits. And it also says you're not required to do an actual cost-benefit analysis for practicability determinations. But there is that paragraph that's in there that very generally outlines what a practicability test should look at.
Mary Beth.
Thank you. Sort of in line with some of these questions and comments, when you look in the document, the decision document, you know, when it looks at economic costs, so just picking one, you know, out of the hat, so to speak, you have a slightly negative short-term cost, but the long-term is positive but uncertain, and that gives you a light color green. And then on a different alternative, which is characterized as red, short-term increases in economic value, but long-term costs. So it appears that, and this could be just perception, and that's why I asked the question, that if you have some short-term economic value that by an alternative, but in the long term you think that, you know, even though that's extremely uncertain, that there's you know, cost that becomes a red. In reverse, you know, we know that it's going to have short-term negative economic impacts, but the very uncertain positive ones of the future, it turns it to a green. So it just seems like there's a bias in there towards the long term, and the long term is very uncertain. And perhaps that's just a misperception I have by looking at the tables.
He just moved that away, and I was going to move it back closer. I'd have to think about the question of, is there a bias towards the long term a little bit more? There potentially could be. That's something I can talk about with Garrett, and we can maybe talk about further a little bit later. I mean, you know, on the one hand, short summary tables are useful because they sort of provide a snapshot and let you compare across the VEX. On the other hand, they mask a lot of issues, and if, you know, an individual council member is very concerned about the level of uncertainty associated with a long-term benefit, then it may be that, you know, more short-term costs are the primary determinant of your decision-making. And so, you know, as we go into final action, maybe we find out that these kind of summary tables sort of boil it down too much and the discussion's really not nuanced enough. You know, I think ideally you would, you know, look at all the details about, well, where do we think are the short-term and long-term, and what fisheries or gears do those crew to, and everybody would come up with their own. Is this highly positive or highly negative sort of assessment? But that's sort of a lot to ask. So the attempt is that these tables sort of simplify it for you, but, you know, we may not, you know, any analyst who's looking at this is sort of going to have some value judgment with it inevitably, and we may not come to the same net conclusion that you would, you know, based on your individual perspective. So I don't know if that was an answer, but I guess I just, you know, just caution people to, as I think you are, to look at the information behind these summary values and not just take them completely at face value.
So just a quick follow-up, if I could, Terry. So I appreciate that answer because I think the quick sort of back-of-the-hand look at the colors and what they represent, it does seem to have a bias, in my opinion, towards long-term benefits that are extremely uncertain. And short-term costs, they're much more certain. And I will spend more time in the details. So thank you, Michelle.
Ellen?
I would like to follow up on what Mary Beth was saying because I found the exact same thing. Throughout the document, every time there was a short-term benefit, there was a sentence that said there would be a large cost in the long term. But what really interested me was that every single time the long-term benefits were listed, it was a definite or uncertain economic benefit, but it was definitely weighted much, much more heavily than anything else. And I think that I have a follow-up on that, and I have two studies that were done. One was the effects of area closures on Georgia's Bank, and the other one was the effects of excluding bottom-disturbing mobile fishing gear on abundance and biomass on Stellwagen Bank. And the first one on Georgia's was by Frank Almeida, Jason Link, Paige Valentine, Peter Oster. And it says, our results suggest few differences between the inside-outside paired stations in both closed areas for Necton and benthic species. And to me, that would say you're looking at the long term as being neutral, possibly, at the very best. And the other study done on Stellwagen, we conclude that the Western Gulf of Maine closed area may be achieving its goal of rebuilding abundances and biomass for some commercially targeted groundfish, but not all. And the study, 6 to 7 years post-closure, establishes require a very different monitoring protocol than the one currently in place if adaptive management is to be successful in the region. And so there are studies that have been done that show that a very positive long-term is not necessarily what is being seen or what will be seen. So I think that you need to keep that in mind when you're making statements. It's really important to keep this non-biased when we look at it. Thank you.
Other questions? Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I found this document remarkably thorough, both all five volumes of the DEIS, its literature survey, its analytical components. It's remarkable that so much complexity could be brought under some sort of manageable body by such a few number of people. So I want to thank you for your work on this, and I find it to be a really important and perhaps even path-breaking study of this region's ecosystem. The question that I have is, do you think, has the economic analyses been reviewed outside, and it's not because I question your work in any way, shape, or form, but for consistency of handling, the Lisa Sassy has been reviewed by external reviewers and or the SSE. The PDT analysis was looked at by and discussed briefly by the SSE. Has the economic analyses had the time to go through that similar external review, whether it's a formal peer review or an SSE review?
It hasn't, no. I think in general, the economic analysis looking at, you know, what types of fishing are occurring in different areas is more straightforward than and more sort of generally used than what we did in terms of estimating habitat vulnerability or using the hotspot statistical approach to identify locations to manage for groundfish purposes. But we haven't had any kind of external review of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and for the indulgence. And the SSC hasn't had a chance to look at any of the alternatives that are before the council today either, have they?
No, the SSC has really looked at the analytical methods for the swept area seabed impact analysis and then also for the groundfish hotspot analysis, but they haven't. And questions were asked during those reviews about the applicability of those approaches to developing management measures, but there hasn't been an SSC evaluation of specific alternatives in the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps
you're on a roll.
Well, I think we're at the stage where I might as well pull this out. We're at the stage now where whatever we do today, and I want to do this now before we get into the political, you know, battles that I'm sure are going to be before us, it seems like it would make a lot of sense, given the highly technical, scientifically based, both social science and natural science nature of this amendment, that we submit it to the alternatives, submit these alternatives to the SSC for them to evaluate it vis-a-vis the requirements that we face under the Act for Habitat Management, EFH. And at the appropriate time, Mr. Chairman, I've got a motion ready to bring that forward when you deem it appropriate.
Yeah, Matt, let's see if there's any other comments or questions for Michelle, and then we'll look for your motion, and then we'll take a break before we jump into the nuts and bolts of the rest of the discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ellen?
Thank you. Michelle, I have a question about page 200. It's the diagram or the graph, and it cites the publication 131, and I'm confused by what it says in that publication. This is talking about the juvenile 0 to 1 age recruitment, and on page 81 of that, do you see where I am? I'm sorry. On that document, it says there's very little relationship between age one recruitment and spawning stock biomass. And so I'm really confused about this whole, the several pages.
Yeah, all it really says is that this is an example of how habitat protection could translate into improved survival and growth of juvenile fish and translate into greater productivity of stock and therefore future yield. The data in CRD 1311 is simply the stock SSB and recruitment estimates from the latest assessment. And what it says is that for Gulf of Maine cod, actually when we get into spawning, I think it talks about in another location, that there's not a strong spawning stock and recruitment relationship here as you might see in some other species. In cases where there is a strong stock recruitment relationship, then you would expect to see a similar benefits in terms of productivity improvements for a habitat closure that that protects age 0 and 1 fish, but in terms of protecting spawning, in terms of spawning closure, you would get a bigger benefit out of a stock that exhibit a strong stock recruitment relationship.
I think that the document says exactly the opposite to that, Andy, but I only read the first half and then the final summary. I think you might want to look at the full document again. It has very definite statements throughout saying that there's very little relationship between H1 recruitment and spawning stock biomass. And so I have a problem with, I guess I have a problem with deciding what juvenile levels we're protecting here.
You have a follow-up, Andy?
I'll reread it before it goes out, but to see if there's a different point of view from the one I see with it.
Any further questions for Michelle and Andy? Laura.
Sorry, I had a question. In terms of the goals and objectives in the beginning of the document, it talks about having a mechanism to determine whether areas that we close are actually working. And I know that's been sort of an issue for industry about the areas that were closed, as you stated, more for mortality closures than for habitat. But has there been any mechanism developed to sort of assess once we decide these areas are closed, to have a mechanism in place to make sure that they're actually reaping the benefits we're hoping that they're going to reap?
Yeah, I'll actually take that question. We did a follow-on analysis to some other it's called a BACI analysis that was performed for certain for the year-round closed areas that exist in Framework 48. The benefits identified from those, and it was an analysis to examine the relative changes in biomass over time inside and outside or adjacent to existing areas. And the benefits of the existing areas were measurable for some species, but not for a lot of species. Some of that could be masked by edge fishing. In other words, increased intensity of fishing surrounding an area that's not captured by that kind of analysis. Going forward, however, the technical teams and the CAT in particular feel it's important to structure and develop some management or some research priorities and direction to better assess the potential benefits or lack thereof of future areas, especially difficult in areas where the areas are smaller than the ones that currently exist. And so there's some description of adding those types of elements into the framework adjustment process and tying it in with the DHRA within the document.
Further questions? Seeing none, back to you, Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your permission, I'd like to make a motion. Karen, I think you have that. Move that the Council task the SSC with providing scientific guidance to the Council no later than August 1, 2014 on the alternatives in the habitat OHA2DEIS, evaluating these alternatives against the goals and objectives for the EFH Omnibus Amendment and the Magnuson-Stevens Act definition on guidance on EFH. If I can get a second, I'll provide a rationale.
Is there a second to the motion? Seconded by Mark Alexander.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is, as we've heard already, just in Michelle's brief overview, this is a very technically precise, scientifically complicated issue. The designation of EFH is largely, in essence, a scientific issue, and it seems incumbent upon us to draw upon our SSC as we would with any other scientific issue in helping us make our decisions. I don't mean this motion in any way to delay the public comment period. I believe we can do this in parallel, and perhaps we can get clarification from that about that. But I think it's incumbent upon us that whatever decisions we make today, we send them by, and whatever alternatives we discuss today, and all the ones before us today, we should run them by the SSC to make sure that they will do what we're supposed to do scientifically. So that's the rationale behind this, and I think it would strengthen our decision-making process.
Okay, my one comment is going to be related to the date certain. We may need to, work with our SSC on an appropriate date should this motion pass. But I'm going to go to Tom and then to the audience, then back to the council.
I guess I have a little bit of concern with this motion. Number one is the timing. Should the council choose to do this, we're going to have to figure out a time that we can get the SSC together to do it, and we're going to have to figure out a way for the staff to prepare for this, because the SSC isn't going to do the work. They're just going to take a look at the analysis that the staff does. So I just want to be upfront that, it will take some effort for us to coordinate this with the SSC. The other piece that's a little bit related to that I'm a little concerned about is the last phrase. Not taking anything away from the SSC, but they're scientists. They're not legal and policy analysts. And I guess I'm a little concerned about asking them to weigh in on whether they think a particular suite of alternatives meets Magnus and Stevenak's guidance on EFH and definitions. I don't know if Gene wants to comment on that or not.
Gene?
Yes, I had the very same concern. It seems to be asking them to make policy, legal determinations in addition to scientific determinations as to whether the alternatives meet the intent of the amendment as well as the legal requirements in the MSA and EFH sections. And without fleshing that out or teasing that out to be more specific as to what's intended, I think that's very problematic.
Before you're ruled out of order, Matt, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Act is, I'm not by no means asking the SSC to give us management guidance. That's clearly not their role. The Act does, however, give fairly precise guidance about the definitions of what is essential fish habitat. That is not a legal definition. That is a scientific definition as the Act has it. That was the reason why I included that last phrase. And the Act also has clear guidance on what EFH is, how it should be defined, and how it should be considered. I accept the comment that the SSC is not here to provide legal and management guidance, and I will, I'm happy to take friendly amendments to structure this away from that interpretation, but the Act does have very clear guidance about the use of science in defining EFH, and how we're supposed to be using it.
John, before I go out to the audience.
I have the same concerns that Tom and Gene have expressed about time, but I temper those concerns about time with the overriding desire to get something that we've been working on for 10 years right. And, we are, what was the word you used? Denouement. What does that mean? We're at the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end? And we're getting close to the finish line. And it's becoming real and specific and detailed and technical, and things are getting into sharp focus, and we are, if we conclude our work tomorrow, going to send things out for public comment. And my guess is judging from the number of people in the audience, going to get lots and lots of comment. And if we end up sending out an alternative that has not already been analyzed, which may happen, then doing an analysis is going to take some additional time. So while we are going to welcome lots of analysis, I'd hate for everyone to be able to give us advice except the SSC. Everyone else is allowed to give us advice. Everyone else can weigh in and tell us what to do. Everyone else can tell us whether they think whatever we send out at the end of tomorrow meets our goals and objectives. Everyone else can do that. Why not the SSC? I'd hate to say that they're the only body who can't tell us whether whatever we send out at the end of tomorrow meets goals and objectives, because when it goes out, everybody else can give us their opinion. That's not to say I agree with what Gene said. I agree with what Tom said about this not being the normal role, but a habitat amendment is not a normal kind of amendment that we're used to sending out either. So I'm not sure how I feel about Matt's motion, but everyone else is going to be able to give us their opinion.
Okay, before I take a number of hands on the council, I'm going to go out to the audience. Ron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz, Fisheries Survival Fund. I have a question first, which is, what's the status of Phase 1, which was the EFH and HAPC? I mean, is that a done deal? Is that a part of this amendment? Has that been reviewed?
So, under Phase 1, which includes updated designations of EFH and updated designation of HAPCs, the council identified preferred alternatives in 2007. And so those are still identified in the document in Volume 2 here as preferred. Phase 1 got a little bit further along in the process as compared to where we are with this phase. They completed the draft EIS, and it was made available to the public, and there was a couple of hearings that were conducted. And that's so basically the process sort of stopped before final action.
So I remember at the end of Phase 1, I was questioning HAPC, saying, how do we haven't even done the analyses. Are we going to come back and revisit HAPCs after we do Phase 2 and do the analyses? And I was told, yes, obviously, we might have to reconsider those. The key point here is I don't think sending anything to the SSC is going to inform the decision. I really hope that we don't look at this as a final thing, that this is an adaptive management process. We're going to end up with a set of habitat measures, but they're not going to be definitive because the science is very weak. And you're just not going to get help from the science. The council is going to have to make its best decisions based on the information at hand. There's a massive amount of information at hand. It's not going to be better informed by a scientific process at this point in time. You're going to take your best guess and go forward with it. And then hopefully we could adapt as we get the science. And that's my...
Chuck.
Judd Crawford, Pew Charitable Trust, thank you. I find it hard to imagine completing a process like this that's been going on for such a long time that is fundamentally scientific without engaging the SSC. The SSC has been engaged at some important points on methodology, the SASE peer review, and some other things. But when the EFH language was introduced in 1996, it was clear that this was a reflection of the realization of the relationship between the fish that we get out of our ecosystems and habitat, the relationship between biological parameters like spawning, breeding, feeding, and growth to maturity. And these are questions that need to be considered from an ecological scientific point of view. And the SSC has a variety of different kinds of expertise on it. It has ecologists on it. It has biologists of various kinds, social scientists. These questions and the purposes of these alternatives that you're grappling with need to be commented on by that body, and I think that advice should be welcomed, and I hope that you will support this proposal. Thank you.
Vito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vito Gigoloni, North East Seafood Coalition. I guess one concern would be the timeline. If for some reason the SSC, in their subjectivity of looking at this scientifically, they end up determining that there's something more that needs to be done, what would that do to the timeline of this amendment? We see that as August. We're aiming for a September vote to send this to the SSC. And I would assume, you know, I have enough faith at this point that there's been an awful lot of analysis and the SASE model was peer-reviewed and that people have looked at this from a statutory standpoint. And I think the reason why we have so many alternatives is it's pretty subjective as to what, you know, is actually protection and what isn't and what is necessary. So I don't... You know, ordinarily I would say that the more eyes look at something, the better, but I'm afraid of the timeline, and I'm not sure it would add much value. So I would say we oppose this motion.
And Greg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg Cunningham with the Conservation Law Foundation. The SSC has played a role in this amendment to date. It has reviewed the SASE, the underlying SASE and LISA analyses, and there has been a peer review process also associated with those models. At that time, there was some question as to whether the outputs from those models would appropriately go to the lead scientific body for this council. Obviously, now is the time to answer that question. We strongly support the idea that a science-based process like this deserves and needs and must have the input from those who guide you on scientific matters. Yes, there is a concern about delay. We've been harping on that for some time throughout this process. If I interpret the date in this motion correctly, my recollection is that this amendment is currently slated for a September vote by the council. This August date would have those conclusions by the SSC in place and available in advance of that vote, recognizing that that vote and that timing may be optimistic at this point, that this council will vote in September. So this appears to account for your current schedule. To the extent that, as was previously mentioned, there is some risk that there's additional delay because the SSC identifies a problem with the amendment, I think we should be thankful that the problem was identified in advance of approval of the amendment. We deal with it at that time, and we correct it. So some delays will be warranted. Let's try to avoid unwarranted delays, and this motion seems to do that. There have been various claims recently, and not so recently, throughout this process by some that there is no science to support the kinds of alternatives, the kinds of measures that you're contemplating as part of this amendment. I am surprised to hear some folks who question the science suggesting that we shouldn't bring it to scientists to see if, in fact, what we're doing is appropriate. That strikes me as precisely what this council needs to do. Thank you.
Is there anybody else? Okay, coming back to the council, I've got Tom, Dave Preble, Terry, Mary Beth, David Pierce, and probably others.
I guess a question for the maker of the motion. Staff has got a little bit of uncertainty about what exactly you're asking the SSC to look at. And the part that we're questioning is the last part where it says guidance on EFH. Are you asking the SSC to review the EFH determinations that are included in the document?
Thank you for that question. No, I'm not asking them to redefine the EFH. That work's been done. It's the suitability of the alternatives that are in the DEIS that we discussed today, and new alternatives that come forward that meet the guidance that the Act provides on EFH, the scientific guidance that the Act provides on EFH. Basically, EFH as it's defined within critical life stages.
So really I want to make sure Michelle's clear, so I'm looking at here. So really here what your motion says is ask the SSC whether these alternatives do what has to be done for EFH. You're not asking the SSC to review all over again the EFH determinations.
That's correct. I think reviewing the EFH determinations is not what I intended. I'm interested in making sure that the alternatives do what we are required to do to meet our legal requirements.
Okay, we're clear.
John Quinn.
Yeah, thank you. I propose a friendly amendment to maybe capture what discussion has been going on here the last 10 to 15 minutes. If you change the comma to a period between DEIS and evaluating and struck out the rest of the language. So we would be getting scientific guidance, but all of this policy making, which is in the second half of the amendment, would go away.
I appreciate the offer. I'm not convinced that I agree with that. Actually, I don't agree with that. That isn't just management advice. That isn't management advice. And after the DEIS comma, as I said before, you know, the Act is pretty clear about how EFH is defined. There are management considerations to that. I'm not asking. I've made it clear before that I'm not asking the SSC to inform us. It's our job, but. In terms of what the Act says about how to define EFH and our scientific commitment, our obligations to conserve and enhance that EFH, we need SSC guidance, or I believe we need SSC guidance to move ahead on that.
So with Matt not feeling friendly, is that a motion to amend? John, are you making a motion to amend? Or?
No.
Okay. Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things. First of all, the sentiments that were expressed by John Bullard are—I agree with that. I agree with what he said. The last thing in the world we want to do is to have this go out with something that we don't anticipate. And the fact is that I was through all of the four peer reviews that SASE. Undertaken, and it is true that they gave very, very high peer review scores to the tool itself. In fact, it was described as being state of the art and better than anything else that was available anywhere. But they did, in fact, question exactly how it was used and wanted to have some input at a later date. That statement is in fact true. It strikes me that what John Quinn just brought up, evaluating these alternatives against the goals and objectives for the EFH Omnibus Amendment and the MSA definition and guidance on EFH, could properly belong with the terms of reference that would go to the SSC. Is that I don't know if that's what he intended, but it seems to me that would be an appropriate place for those parts of this motion.
And I think that we need to structure it in that way. We want the SSC to look at the alternatives that we have available that are moving forward. But to say what exactly, how exactly the SSC does that, I think is probably not our job. I'm not convinced that a period at that point is exactly right. Something maybe should be said, but the motion as it sits there, I think is too ambitious in terms of telling the SSC exactly what to do. So I'm not sure yet. I think this is an excellent idea. To me, it came out of the blue. I did not expect this, but it makes perfect sense. And I think it needs to be done. But I'm not really comfortable with the motion.
Okay, Terry.
I'll pass.
Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Based on the advice that we've gotten from Gene and the service, and I can't support this motion with that second last sentence in there, because that's asking them to evaluate the alternatives against the goals and objectives. That is our job. It is not the SSC's job. So I'm going to make a motion to to put a period at the end of DEIS and delete the last sentence. That's a motion to amend.
Motion to amend by Doug. Is there a second? Second by Ellen. PK.
I still have a problem with the motion as amended. You know, we weight the SSC very heavily, as we should. But this has been a long process, and we've gone through this process. And if the guidance doesn't come out something that we like, regardless of what alternative we pick, this is just going to delay this a lot longer. I don't think putting that date of August 1st in there, if we can have it by a September council meeting, I agree with what Vito said earlier. This has been a long process, and as a council, I think we've, you know, Doug tried to get to that to amend the motion, but I think we've had plenty of time to go over this and evaluate it. We've had plenty of input from all different types of people. We still don't know if the alternatives we pick, if the agency is still going to approve them. So I won't be supporting either motion. Thank you.
Mayor Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also won't be supporting either motion. I appreciate Doug's attempt here to make it more palatable, I guess. But, I mean, the part that bothers me now is that we're asking to comment on the alternatives in the document. And I've seen the SSC. I mean, we've limited our SSC primarily to scientific advice on catch limits. A lot of that is really just because of workload, and we have people on the SSC from, you know, who are economists and social scientists, and I think we could improve our use of those people. However, I think that the underlying issue here is what is the role for the SSC, and in my mind, and what I've seen it used in other regions, is that they provide us advice on whether the analysis in the document is supportable or not, whether it's adequate enough to support the council's documents, not commenting on what the alternatives are. I agree, you know, that is the purview of the council to select and develop alternatives. So I appreciate this effort, Doug, but I won't be supporting either.
David Pearson.
Yeah, I won't repeat some of the comments already made before me, such as Doug's comment and Mary Beth's. It's our job to make the call. There's 10 goals. There's 14 objectives. My goodness, I look at them all, and I say, giving this to the SSC for them to look at the strategies versus the objectives and the goals. It's, frankly, I think, a tremendous waste of time on our part. We can make the call now. We depended upon our excellent staff to prepare for us a decision document with tables that provide us with the ability to evaluate quite well all these different alternatives relative to the objectives, all these colored charts to give us a good indication of where we stand relative to what's going to be achieved or not, at least our expectations. So the work's been done already. We have the CAT. We have the plan development team. They drew upon the scientists in different state agencies. They drew upon scientists in other in academia. A lot's been done on this already. I really don't want to waste any more time on this amendment. That is, I want to get it out to public hearing. We are in a position to make our preferred alternatives. And frankly, if either of these motions was to pass, I don't think I'd be willing to vote for any preferred alternatives because I would want to wait for the SSC to weigh in. But we don't have to. We've got it before us now, laid out with a great blueprint that will, I think, enable us to make some wise choices for preferred alternatives. Then we get it out to public hearing and see how it all plays out. So I can't support either motion. We've already spent a lot of time on it today. It's almost 1 o'clock. I had thought we would have gotten through the Gulf of Maine already, but apparently that's not going to happen.
You're an optimistic man. Mark Gibson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm in opposition to both motions. I think either one has a substantial risk of gumming up the works at this late date with very little value added from the effort. I think a long time ago, all of us came to the conclusion that we would eventually run out of the science with which to guide us. We would run to its limits, and we knew that we were going to have to make judgments based on our best discussions and arguments here and you know, exercise our judgment over over the final decisions, and I think we're close to that point now, and I think we should move ahead with that. Thank you.
Laura, then Matt's got last word. We're going to move the question.
I'm opposed to both of the motions for all the reasons everyone has already mentioned, and I don't repeat myself because, you know, meeting efficacy is one of my strong suits. But I would say that I don't think, Matt, that this is, if these were to fail, it precludes us going to the SSC should we get a lot of public comment where it really seems divided about the best alternative, and that at a June meeting we may find ourselves saying, well, let's task the SSC to look at the merits of this alternative versus that alternative in this specific region, that wouldn't be saying carte blanche to every alternative that really, as Mary Beth and Dr. Pierce pointed out, would just be a colossal use of time. And so I just wanted to make the point that I don't think it precludes using the SSC as a tool going forward, but perhaps we wait till we have some very significant things that we need them to focus on. Thank you.
Wrap us up, Matt.
I'll be brief. In response, yes, it does not preclude us, but I think that would delay it even more, and it seems to me more effective from a procedural perspective. If we're going to be drawing upon the SSC's advice, as we should, this is a scientific decision we are making, then we need to, it seems expedient to have them tasked with evaluating our range of alternatives today while we're also sending out to public comment. I'm open to the idea of crafting TORs that might be more amenable to the council. I think that's a good place for the more specific comments that Dave Preble had. I'd be open to that. But I really think it's incumbent upon us that to defend our – we have not exhausted the science here. We haven't technically even tasked them with looking at the alternatives. They've evaluated the constituent parts, but they have not looked at all the pieces of it put together. And that's why I made this motion. But I think I see where this is going to go, so I will not take any more time.
Thank you. Council members, to the motion of the board, those who support it, please indicate so. On the motion to amend. And those opposed. And abstentions? One. Motion fails. 213-1. We're back to the main motion. Same sign. Those who support the motion on the board, please indicate so. And those opposed. And one abstention. So the main motion fails. 213-1. Excuse me. There's three in favor. 3-12-1. It's quarter of one. It's time for lunch. Let's take a break and be back here at 1 hour, and we will jump right into Michelle's next presentation. Karen?
Yeah.
There is a buffet available for those who choose to eat here at the hotel.